fascism against Christianity, the great liberation, let us conclude. Today we must absolutely put a stop to Christianity. Everything in it is incompatible with and contradictory to the ideals, the morals, the vision of the world and of man that would enable a race to bring about the resurrection of the empire. Our sleep has lasted long enough. All the possible compromises and variations have been exhausted. It is time to say enough. No more of Christianity embraced as a whole, in the totality of all its forms. The Latin race in particular must bitterly disavow any descent from the dark object that emerged from the Jewish slums of Palestine to contaminate us. Thus, on an ideal and moral level, it is time to unmask Christianity's enormous doctrinal bluff and to refuse to allow it to continue to parade around loaded up with all the values that have been superstitiously and unconsciously attributed to it. On a practical level, it is time to become aware of the European danger and the decline of the West and to respond by reviving in the modern world the political and sapiential values characteristic of the Mediterranean tradition. Ethical and religious Christianity today is nothing more than an aim and a habit, absolutely external to conscience, but nobody, or nearly nobody, has bothered to abolish the name itself and to put its content on trial again, so as to start right back at the beginning, rejecting the fact of Christianity, its tradition and all the rest. This is precisely my intent, to hold such a trial, demanding that every account to be scrutinized with inflexible severity, that all cards be placed openly on the table, and that every way out and every compromise be barred in advance. At stake are not more or less anti-clerical polemics but rather a serious, objective examination, unbiased by feeling and belief. A cool-headed examination should suffice to blunt the ecstatic thrill and to unmask the true poverty and inferiority of the Christian vision of the world and of man. With regard to fascism, I declare, fascism will blaze the path toward breaking up the monstrous political connivance with the Catholic Church, abetted by the intrigues of that secret and illicit association, the Society of Jesus. It will become aware that it has fallen prey to a sucker's marketplace. The petty political advantages to be gained are trivial when compared to the Church's devious efforts to achieve monopoly control over Italy's conscience by means of public education and clever sophistries that polarize the fascist regime against everything that is not Catholic. To have agreed that a crucifix should be placed not in the universities, not in the Colosseum, but on the Campidoglio in place of the eagle and the fasces is a blot without precedent that it will take a lot to wipe away. This transpired because fascism still lacks spirituality and culture of its own, as fresh and vibrant as the warrior forces that brought it into being. The result was that fascism's political triumph was unaccompanied by a spiritual cultural triumph. This transpired because fascism is still crippled by a definition of empire as a simple political, economic, and military organization, based on the industrial capitalist system and cast in the mold of British and German bourgeois and material imperialism. But such a definition has nothing in common with true imperialism, that spiritual, sacred, and heroic imperialism of ancient Rome, Byzantium, and Persia. The real explanation for the success of Catholic infiltration lies in fascism's actual indifference to spiritual questions, whereby it did not hesitate to embrace new members who could solidify the material structure of the new regime, even at the cost of accommodating the most strident of contradictions. Once fascism transcends the bourgeois industrial definition of empire, once it embraces imperiousness in the true, traditional sense, the problem will be resolved. Fascism will find its soul within itself, a fact that will paralyze all efforts to apply external pressure and render ever more acute the incompatibility between state and church. Incompatibility not as understood by demagogic, anti-clerical, or secular ideologies but in the sense that the empire would become the true spiritual reality, the imminent, powerful religion that ousts the dead hierarchies and empty devotional forms that have survived in Catholicism. Julia Savola, Revolt Against the Modern World. So if the daring that fascism regularly exalts is more than rhetorical bluster, here's a first task: deride the arrogance that did not hesitate to call the King of Italy a usurper from on the high at the Vatican and reaffirm the complete dominion of the state over the Church. The Church must be directly controlled by the state. Its every organization must require state approval and sanction. Above all, It must be denied any role in the education of souls during the period in which the will is not yet formed and the conscience is not yet clear. So much for Catholicism, which on a practical plane must be distinguished from Christianity. The latter is mostly to be identified with the forms of Protestantism active in Anglo-Saxon liberal democracies. Here lies the true European danger from which we must protect ourselves, reacting ruthlessly to all the international, unionist, Masonic, anti-aristocratic, anti-Roman, socialist, humanitarian, moralist ferments with which it would seek to infiltrate Italy. In the properly cultural field, fascism ought to begin by promoting critical and historical studies, not partisan studies but cold surgical analyses of the essence of Christianity akin to Louis Rougier's work in France, published in his collection, Masters of Anti-Christian Thought. At the same time, fascism ought to promote studies and research on the spiritual side of paganism studies extending from paganism's true vision of life to rigorously appropriate explorations of the Mediterranean tradition in its primitive and metaphysical nature. Let the following be stated firmly, absolutely, and unambiguously. We are not destroyers but restorers. When we appear to be destroying, we are in fact rearranging and replacing what is on the wane with higher forms, forms more vibrant and glorious. We possess a complete, total, positive system of values, developed in close connection with the forms of contemporary civilization, a system that provides us with a firm foundation and frees us from any fear of the void as we demolish all the negatives of European decadence. From the standpoint of its praxis, fascism must not betray itself, which is to say, it must deeply embrace those values of affirmation, activity, will to power, anti-sentimentalism, and anti-rhetoricism whose imprint it bears. Values that are essentially anti-Christian. Values to be raised to a higher internalized and spiritualized form and freed from the inferior and provisional approach based on mere violence and material domination. And here there is a precursor, a misunderstood man, who waits in the shadows, Friedrich Nietzsche. The Nietzschean experiment is not yet exhausted because it hasn't even truly begun. What is worn out is the aesthetic literary or firebrand caricature of Nietzsche found in characters like Corrado Brando, Stelio Ifrina, or William II. But very much alive are values that Nietzsche heroically propagated despite no end of suffering, despite the rebellion of his entire being, which, after having given everything without complaint, simply collapsed. These values transcend his philosophy, his humanity, even himself. They are of cosmic significance, reflecting the power of the Yin, the Er, the terrible fire of magical initiations. These are the values that are still waiting to be understood and taken up. They encompass the sounding of an alarm, an appeal for disgust, the call for an awakening, and a summons to participate in the great struggle in which the destiny of the West will be decided, whether toward twilight or toward dawn. Fascism must begin here, by beginning the slow, tenacious construction of a new and wondrous race. Accordingly, education will be reoriented toward pagan and Mediterranean values. The myth of the crucified God-man who suffers and loves will be opposed that of the man-god, a being radiating light and power, the summit of an imperial ethos. To a dualistic and transcendental worldview will be opposed a vision of free and immanent unity, withdrawn into itself, matter for domination. To Christianity's race of slaves and children of God will be opposed a race of liberated and liberating beings who interpret God as a supreme power that one may freely obey or do battle against in manly fashion with one's head held high, immune to the taint of feelings, vacillations, and prayers. To feelings of dependence and lack will be opposed a feeling of sufficiency, to the will to equality, the will to difference, distance, hierarchy, and aristocracy. To the mystical communist promiscuity will be opposed firm individuality, to the need for love, happiness, peace, and consolation, the heroic contempt for all this and law of pure will and absolute action. To Christianity's providential vision will be opposed the tragic conception whereby man stands alone facing the contingencies of nature such that either he must redeem himself or redemption will forever elude him. To away with sin and bad conscience brashly heap all responsibilities upon one's shoulders, bar the door to any escape, fortify the innermost spirit. No more brothers or fathers but instead a fully autonomous individuals, self-enclosed as if each were a separate world, rock, or peak, individuals clothed only in their strength or in their weakness, each and every one operating like an independent combat post that defends a distinctive quality, life, dignity, unequal strength, indomitable force. No more subjection to the need to communicate, and to be understood or to fraternal bonds or to the sensual pleasure of loving and of feeling loved as equals. All are subtly corrupting and violent forces that weaken aristocracy and individuality. On the contrary, the incommunicability must be celebrated in the name of absolute purity and respect. Stronger forces and weaker forces, the one alongside or against the order, loyally, coldly, acknowledging one another thanks to the discipline of the spirit that burns within but produces an exterior rigid and tempered like steel, forces magnificently infused with the immeasurability of the infinite as found in feats of war and on the battlefield. A state of absolute generosity and absolute cruelty ensure that some men and races ascend, while others fall with a thud. Nothing infinite. Precise relations, order, cosmos, hierarchy. Solar and sufficient beings, masters who are far-sighted, fearful, distant, and solitary, who, instead of taking in, give out an overabundance of light and power, who resolutely incline toward ever more dizzying intensities within a hierarchical chain of being that comes not from above but from the dynamic natural interconnection between their natures. How beautiful they are, how pure are these free forces not yet corrupted by the spirit. Wrote the young Nietzsche after an ascent during a storm. In the place of Nietzsche's not yet, I would substitute no longer corrupted by the spirit in the present context, the word spirit meaning the unreal, an outer crust of feelings, hopes, doctrines, beliefs, values, sensations, words, sensual pleasures, and human emotions. But the meaning remains the same. The world is to be cleansed, returned to its pre-Christian state. It is to be returned to a free, overabundant, essential state within which nature is not yet nature or the spirit, in which things and forms do not exist except as powers, in which every instant of life is a heroic event, made up of acts, symbols, commands, magical gestures, and rituals, accompanied by great waves of sound, light, and terror. This is our truth and this is the threshold of our great liberation. The end of faith and the world's emancipation from God. No heaven will hover over the land, gone will be providence, reason, good, and evil, masks for the terrified, pallid escapes for pallid souls. At last, those who think themselves men, unaware that they are sleeping gods, will be left to themselves, everything, all around, will return to a state of freedom, everything will finally breathe. The weak will collapse. The strong will assert themselves and will be rekindled as the holy race of the kingless of the ancient Gnostic oracles, the race of those who are, of the unchained and the unburdened, of redeemed justifiers of the world, lords of necessity and suffering. This is our truth. This is the myth that we pagans oppose to the superstition of Galilee, the myth that we affirm today as central to the values of our race and to the restoration of the empire in the West. Tradition, Catholicism, Ghibellinism, Detroit Southgate. Catholicism is perceived by many to be the pinnacle of tradition. Avolo accepts that it contains many traditional aspects, but goes on to say that in order to be seen as a legitimate form of authority and sovereignty it must become fully integrated within the sphere of tradition itself. Catholicism alone is inadequate and represents only a minimal current of a far wider tradition. Here, Avolo opts to discuss the implications of this fact in both the political and contemporary context, despite using examples from the past. Religion falls into various categories and cannot match the supreme and unitary nature of tradition. In fact, religion is simply an exoteric version of a deeper, esoteric undercurrent. Christianity, for example, panders to the masses, whilst tradition is reserved for the spiritual elite. In effect, nobody with a higher education can really believe in the axiom there is no salvation outside the church, meaning the great civilizations that have preceded Christianity have not known the supernatural or the sacred, but only distorted images and obscure prefigurations, and that they amount to mere paganism, polytheism, and natural mysticism. This statement would undoubtedly arouse in the more traditional Catholic a feeling of revulsion and anger, perhaps even accusations of ecumenicalism. However, Avolo is not advocating the unification of all religions, but the acceptance that there is a common tradition which lies in each. He goes on to say that for a Catholic to persist in the sectarian and dogmatic exclusivism about this matter would amount to being in the same predicament of one who wished to defend the views of physics and astronomy found in the Old Testament, which have been made obsolete by the current state of knowledge on these matters. Catholicism, then, is only traditional in the sense that certain aspects tend to accord with tradition itself. The same can be said of Islam or Judaism. We now turn our attention to the centuries-old debate concerning Catholicism and Ghibellinism. The Ghibellines were a political force in northern and central Italy between the 12th and 15th centuries. These opposing groups began in Germany as partisans in a struggle for the throne of the Holy Roman Empire between two dynastic houses, the Welfs on the one hand, and the Hohenstaufens on the other. During the 13th century, the Welf leader, Otto of Brunswick, was involved in a fratricidal struggle for the imperial crown against Frederick II of Hohenstaufen, and the all-German battle soon moved south to Italy. The name Guelph is derived from Welf, whilst Ghibellin is a corruption of Weiblingen, an area of land belonging to the emperors of Hohenstaufen. According to the Ghibellin view of the world, as elucidated by Avola, the empire was an institution of supernatural origin and character, like the church. It had its own sacred nature, just as, during the Middle Ages, the dignity of the kings themselves had an almost priestly nature. On this basis, the Ghibellin emperors, who were the representatives of a universal and supranational idea, embodying Lex Animata in Terris, opposed the hegemonic claims of the clergy and claimed to have only God above themselves. The struggle between the Ghibellines and the clergy is usually discussed in political terms, but was actually a form of spiritual combat waged at the very highest level. Humanity, during the medieval period, was caught between two distinct paths: action and contemplation. Avola tells us that this relates to the empire and the church respectively. Ghibellinism more or less claimed that through the view of earthly life as discipline, militia, and service, the individual can be led beyond himself and reach the supernatural culmination of human personality through action and under the aegis of the empire. This was related to the character of a non-naturalistic but providential institution acknowledged in the empire. Knighthood and the great knightly orders stood in relation to the empire in the same way in which the clergy and the ascetic orders stood in relation to the church. This sounds like an analogy of the political soldier, but Avola is keen to demonstrate that such orders were based on an idea that was less political than ethical, spiritual, and partially even ascetic, according to an asceticism that was not cloistered and contemplative, but rather of a warrior type. In this last regard, the most typical example was constituted by the Order of Knights Templar, and in part by the Order of the Teutonic Knights. This subject is discussed at length in Avola's Revolt Against the Modern World, during which the author explained how the emperor waged a calculated holy war against the pro-Guelphist clergy and how even the Crusades became an active consolidation of the imperial idea, just as the empire had been in times of peace. The Ghibellines, he said, were engaged in an occult struggle against papal Rome that was waged by Rome itself. Indeed, the head of the church is known as Pontifex Maximus, a title which is taken directly from the leaders of early Rome. Indeed, according to Avola, the Emperor Julian opposed Christianity due to its upholding of an anarchical doctrine, with the excuse of paying homage to God alone. They refused to give him homage in the person of those who, as legitimate leaders of men, were his representatives on earth and drew from him the principle of their power. This, according to Celsus, was an example of impiety. Avola's whole point is that in ancient times the religious clergy were answerable to the emperor himself, not simply from a political perspective, but also in a theological capacity. It was only during the Middle Ages that the priest nourished the ambition, not of being king, but of being the one to whom kings are subject. At that time, Ghibellinism arose as a reaction, and the rivalry was rekindled, the new reference point now being the authority and the right reclaimed by the Holy Roman Empire. But this does not presuppose that religion must be at the service of the state like those of a Masonic, anti-clerical character. On the contrary, this leads to totalitarianism and the concordats which were conveniently arranged in both Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. The separation of the spiritual and political spheres is epitomized by the Christian maxim, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's, something which was quite unknown in ancient times. Needless to say, throughout history the Catholic Church has played a very large role in secular affairs by using politics as a mere wing of the religious establishment. Although in the later Middle Ages the Church did recognize the divine right of kings, Evola considers these atheistic monarchs to have been at the forefront of the liberal ideas which later found expression in the French Revolution of 1789. Once the state had vacated the domain of the spirit and become secular, however, it turned against the Church. But this was different to the rebellion of the Ghibellines, because this current did not pursue the subjection of spiritual authority to temporal powers, but rather upheld this Vichy exclusivist claim of the Church, a value and a right for the state, different from those that are proper to an organization with a merely human and material character. However, lest one wrongly imagine that Evola somehow wishes to revive the Ghibelline struggle against the Church, the author carefully points out that the key point is to resist the secular state in all its forms. Only in this way can politics be ascribed to a higher level. Catholicism today is in great decline, not least because it is always forced to compromise with the prevailing ideologies among which it finds itself. Liberalism is gradually eroding the last vestiges of Catholic tradition in the same way that it is eating away at the edifice of tradition in general. The likes of the Protestant Reformation and Vatican II have taken their toll, and we now see modernist popes tolerating bastardized currents like liberation theology, supporting the burgeoning New World Order and kneeling before the might of international Zionism. Evola tells us that the decline of the modern church is undeniable because she gives to social and moral concerns a greater weight than what pertains to the supernatural life, to asceticism, and to contemplation, which are essential reference points of religiosity. It is certainly not fulfilling any kind of meaningful role, either. For all practical purposes, the main concerns of Catholicism today seem to turn it into a petty bourgeois moralism that shuns sexuality and upholds virtue, or an inadequate paternalistic welfare system. In these times of crisis and emerging brutal forces, the Christian faith should devote itself to very different tasks. In the medieval period, the Church possessed a more traditional character, but only due to the fact that it had appropriated so many classical elements and, by way of Aristotle, lashed them firmly to the theological mast being constructed by Thomas Aquinas during the 13th century. Catholicism, however, will never reconcile itself with the problem of how to deal with politics and the state because it relies upon separation and dualism. Tradition, on the other hand, is integralist and unitary. Evola notes that certain individuals and groups have sought to incorporate the more traditional aspects of Catholicism within the broader and far more encompassing sphere of tradition itself. Evola's French philosophical counterpart, René Guénon, for example. Catholics, however, are far too dogmatic and would merely seek to make tradition conform to their own spiritual Weltanschauung. This, says Evola, is placing the universal at the service of the particular. Furthermore, of course, the anti-modernists who are organized in groups such as the Society of Saint Pius X and the Sede Vacantist Fraternity do not speak with the full weight and authority of the Church. They are, therefore, powerless because the direction of the Church is a descending and anti-traditional one, consisting of modernization and coming to terms with the modern world, democracy, socialism, progressivism, and everything else. Therefore, these individuals are not authorized to speak in the name of Catholicism, which ignores them, and should not try to attribute to Catholicism a dignity the latter spurns. Evola suggests that because the Church is so inadequate, it should be abandoned and left to its ultimate doom. He concludes by reiterating the fact that a state which does not have a spiritual dimension is not a state at all. The only way forward, he argues, is to begin from a pure idea, without the basis of approximate historical reference and await the actualization of the traditional current. Troy Southgate examines late Italian philosopher Julius Evola's Men Among the Ruins, Post-War Reflections of a Radical Traditionalist. This is Chapter 10, Autore Curatore, Troy Southgate font, Julius Savola, a radical traditionalist tratoda, lingua, inglese data di publicazione su Julius Evola.it, 10/07/2004 from now, without wanting to minimize the possible religious, cultural, and political errors propagated by some or all of the nefarious groups just listed, mere opposition to them does not guarantee truth in its opponents, far from it. Many of the nouvelle droite or third position value the faith, as Maros and Primo de Rivera were rightly or wrongly accused of, purely as a cultural institution, incarnating the values of the West. Still others, such as the late Julius Evola and Alain de Benoist, reject Catholicism entirely as a Semitic corruption of Europe's Aryan or Indo-European pagan heritage, an analysis shared with, among others, Nazi theorist Alfred Rosenberg. My late lamented friend, Thomas Molnar, wrote a brilliant book specifically on these folk. But whether or not such people openly worship Thor or whomever or not, they make an idol for themselves of the nation, the race, or the West itself. Akin to but distinct from this current is that of traditionalism, which word in this sense has nothing to do with traditionally minded Catholics, but rather refers to schools of thought launched by such figures as the aforementioned Julius Evola, René Guénon, Oswald Spengler, Fridtjof Schuon, Hermann Count Kaiserling, and Mircea Eliade, among others. For these men, either the West or all mankind are undergirded by a universal tradition, of which the various religions and cultures were all more or less legitimate expressions, and all are equally threatened by a variously described phenomenon that might be called modernity or modernism. Soulless and materialist, this enemy, of whom the various organizations described earlier may or may not be minions, shall strangle all that is true or beautiful or good. Man shall be left in its wake either an unconscious automaton mindlessly doing his master's bidding, slaughtered by neo-barbarians destroying his corrupt civilization, or some combination of the two. Now, to be fair, all of these thinkers and their ilk have insights, some very good indeed. But the problem once more is that they tend to subordinate the faith to something else. In this particular case, its value is merely that of one vessel of a more important thing. Nor is it necessarily the best vessel, as Guénon showed by becoming a Muslim, since, as he thought, Islam is more faithful to itself than Catholicism. Against the neo-pagans extract from Gruntrissa by Julius Evola the misunderstandings of the new paganism, it is perhaps appropriate to point out the misunderstandings that are current at the moment in some radical circles, who believe that a solution lies in the direction of a new paganism. This misunderstanding is already visible in the use of terms such as pagan and pagandom. I myself, having used these expressions as slogans in a book that was published in Italy in 1928, and in Germany in 1934, have cause for sincere regrets. Certainly the word for pagan or heathen, paganus, appears in some ancient Latin writers such as Livy without an especially negative tone. But this does not alter the fact that with the arrival of the new faith, the word paganus became a decidedly disparaging expression, as used in early Christian apologetics. It derives from pagus, meaning a small town or village, so that paganus refers to the peasant way of thinking, an uncultured, primitive, and superstitious way. In order to promote and glorify the new faith, the apologists had the bad habit of elevating themselves through the denigration of other faiths. There was often a conscious and often systematic disparagement and misrepresentation of almost all the earlier traditions, doctrines, and religions, which were grouped under the contemptuous blanket term of paganism or heathendom. To this end, the apologists obviously made a premeditated effort to highlight those aspects of the pre-Christian religions and traditions that lacked any normal or primordial character, but were clearly forms that had fallen into decay. Such a polemical procedure led, in particular, to the characterization of whatever had preceded Christendom, and was hence non-Christian, as necessarily anti-Christian. One should consider, then, that paganism is a fundamentally tendentious and artificial concept that scarcely corresponds to the historical reality of what the pre-Christian world always was in its normal manifestations, apart from a few decadent elements and aspects that derived from the degenerate remains of older cultures. Once we are clear about this, we come today to a paradoxical realization, that this imaginary paganism that never existed, but was invented by Christian apologists, is now serving as the starting point for certain so-called pagan circles, and is thus threatening for the first time in history to become a reality, no more and no less than that. What are the main traits of today's pagan outlook, as its own apologists believe and declare them to be? The primary one is the imprisonment in nature. All transcendence is totally unknown to the pagan view of life. It remains stuck in a mixture of spirit and nature, in an ambiguous unity of body and soul. There is nothing to its religion but a superstitious deification of natural phenomena, or of tribal energies promoted to the status of minor gods. Out of this there arises first of all a blood and soil-bound particularism. Next comes a rejection of the values of personality and freedom, and a condition of innocence that is merely that of the natural man, as yet unawakened to any truly supernatural calling. Beyond this innocence there is only lack of inhibition, sin, and the pleasure of sinning. In other domains there is nothing but superstition, or a purely profane culture of materialism and fatalism. It is as though only the arrival of Christianity allowed the world of supernatural freedom to break through, letting in grace and personality, in contrast to the fatalistic and nature-bound beliefs ascribed to paganism, bringing with it a Catholic ideal and a healthy dualism, which made it possible to subjugate nature to a higher law, and for the spirit to triumph over the law of flesh, blood, and the false gods. These are the main traits of the dominant understanding of paganism, i.e., of everything that does not entail a specifically Christian worldview. Anyone who possesses any direct acquaintance with cultural and religious history, however elementary, can see how incorrect and one-sided this attitude is. Besides, in the early church fathers there are often signs of a higher understanding of the symbols, doctrines, and religions of preceding cultures. Here we will give only a sampling. What most distinguished the pre-Christian world, in all its normal forms, was not the superstitious divinization of nature, but a symbolic understanding of it, by virtue of which every phenomenon and every event appeared as the sensible revelation of a suprasensible world. The pagan understanding of the world and of man was essentially marked by sacred symbolism. Moreover, the pagan way of life was absolutely not that of a mindless innocence, nor a natural abandonment to the passions, even if certain forms of it were obviously degenerate. It was already aware of a healthy dualism, which is reflected in its universal religious or metaphysical conceptions. Here we can mention the dualistic warrior religion of the ancient Iranian Aryans, already discussed and familiar to all, the Hellenistic antithesis between the two natures, between world and underworld, or the Nordic one between the race of the Asses and the elementary beings, and lastly the Indo-Aryan contrast between Samsara, the stream of forms, and Mukti, liberation and perfection. On this basis, all the great pre-Christian cultures shared the striving for a supernatural freedom, i.e., for the metaphysical perfection of the personality, and they all acknowledged mysteries and initiations. I have already pointed out that the mysteries often signified the reconquest of the primordial state, the spirituality of the solar, Hyperborean races, on the foundation of a tradition and a knowledge that were concealed through secrecy and exclusivity from the pollutions of an environment already in decay. We have also seen that in the eastern lands, the Aryan quality was already associated with a second birth achieved through initiation. As for natural innocence as the pagan cult of the body, that is a fairy tale and not even in evidence among savages, for despite the inner lack of differentiation already mentioned in connection with races close to nature, these people inhibit and constrict their lives through countless taboos in a way that is often stricter than the morality of the so-called positive religions. And as for that which seems to the superficial view to embody the prototype of such innocence, namely the classical ideal, that was no cult of the body, it did not belong on that side of the body-spirit duality, but on the other side. As already stated, the classic ideal is that of a spirit that is so dominant that under certain favorable spiritual conditions it molds body and soul to its own image, and thereby achieves a perfect harmony between the inner and the outer. Lastly, there is an aspiration away from particularism to be found everywhere in the pagan world, to which was due the imperial summons that marked the ascending phase of the Nordic-derived races. Such a summons was often metaphysically enhanced and refined, and appeared as the natural consequence of the expansion of the ancient sacred state concept, also as the form in which the victorious presence of the higher world and the paternal, Olympian principle sought to manifest itself in the world of becoming. In this respect, we might recall the old Iranian concept of empire and of the King of Kings, with its associated doctrine of the Horenu, and the Indo-Aryan tradition of the world king or Kekravato, etc., right up to the reappearance of these signifiers in the Olympian assumptions of the ancient Roman idea of state and empire. The Roman Empire, too, had its sacred contents, which were systematically misunderstood or undervalued not only by Christendom, but also by the writers of positive history. Even the emperor cult had the sense of a hierarchical unity at the top of a pantheon, which was a series of separate territorial and ancestral cults belonging to the non-Roman peoples, which were freely respected so long as they kept within their normal boundaries. Finally, concerning the pagan unity of the two powers, spiritual and temporal, this was very far from meaning that they were fused as a solar race understood it. It expressed the superior rights that must accrue to the spiritual authority at the center of any normal state. Thus it was something quite different from the emancipation and supremacy of a merely secular state. If we were to make similar amendments in the spirit of true objectivity, the possibilities would be overwhelming. Further misunderstandings concerning the pagan worldview. This having been said, there remains the real possibility of transcending certain aspects of Christianity. But one must be quite clear, the Latin term transcendere means literally leaving something behind as one rises upwards, and not downwards. It is worth repeating that the principal thing is not the rejection of Christianity, it is not a matter of showing the same incomprehension towards it as Christianity itself has shown, and largely continues to show, towards ancient paganism. It would rather be a matter of completing Christianity by means of a higher and an older heritage, eliminating some of its aspects and emphasizing other, more important ones, in which this faith does not necessarily contradict the universal concepts of pre-Christian spirituality. This, alas, is not the path taken by the radical circles we have mentioned. Many of these neo-pagans seem to have fallen into a trap deliberately set for them, often ending up by advocating and defending ideas that more or less correspond to that invented, nature-bound, particularistic pagandom, lacking light and transcendence, which was the polemical creation of a Christian misunderstanding of the pre-Christian world, and which is based, at most, on a few scattered elements of that world in its decline and devolution. And as if this were not enough, people often resort to an anti-Catholic polemic which, whatever its political justification, often drags out and adapts the old clichés of a purely modern, rationalist and Enlightenment type that have been well used by liberalism, democracy, and Freemasonry. This was also the case, to a degree, with H.S. Chamberlain, and it appears again in a certain Italian movement that has been trying to connect racial thinking with the idealistic doctrine of immanence. There is a general and unmistakable tendency in neo-paganism to create a new, superstitious mysticism, based on the glorification of immanence, of life and nature, which is in the sharpest contrast to that Olympian and heroic ideal of the great Aryan cultures of pre-Christian antiquity. It would indicate much more a turning towards the materialistic, maternal, and telluric side, if it did not exhaust itself in foggy and dilettantish philosophizing. To give an example, we might ask what exactly is meant by this nature, on which these groups are so keen? It is little use to point out that it is certainly not the nature that was experienced and recognized by ancient, traditional man, but a rational construct of the French encyclopedist period. It was the encyclopedists who, with definitely subversive and revolutionary motives, made up the myth of nature as good, wise, and wholesome, in opposition to the rottenness of every human culture. Thus we can see that the optimistic nature myth of Rousseau and the encyclopedists marches in the same ranks as natural right, universalism, liberalism, humanitarianism, and the denial of any positive and structured form of sovereignty. Moreover, the myth in question has absolutely no basis in natural history. Every honest scientist knows that there is no room for nature in the framework of his theories, which have as their object the determination of purely abstract equivalences and mathematical relationships. As far as biological research and genetics are concerned, we can already see the disequilibrium that would occur the moment one held certain laws to be final, when they only apply to a partial aspect of reality. What people call nature today has nothing to do with what nature meant to the traditional, solar man, or to the knowledge of it that was accessible to such a man thanks to his Olympian and regal position. There is no sign of this whatever in the advocates of this new mysticism. Misunderstandings of more or less the same kind arise regarding political thought. Paganism is here often used as the synonym for a merely worldly and yet exclusive concept of sovereignty, which turns the relationships upside down. We have already seen that in the ancient states, the unity of the two powers meant something quite different. It provided the basis for the spiritualization of politics, whereas neo-paganism results in actually politicizing the spiritual, and thereby treading once again the false path of the Gallicans and Jacobins. In contrast, the ancient concept of state and empire always showed a connection to the Olympian idea. What shall we think of the attitude that regards Jewry, Rome, the Catholic Church, Freemasonry, and communism as more or less one and the same thing, just because their presuppositions differ from the plain thinking of the folk? The folk's thinking along these lines threatens to lose itself in the dark, where no differentiation is possible anymore. It shows that it has lost the genuine feeling for the hierarchy of values, and that it cannot escape the crippling alternative of destructive internationalism and nationalistic particularism, whereas the traditional understanding of the empire is superior to both these concepts. To restrict ourselves to a single example, Catholic dogmatism actually fulfills a useful preventive role by stopping worldly mysticism and such like eruptions from below from passing a certain frontier. It makes a strong dam that protects the area where transcendent knowledge and the genuinely supernatural and non-human elements reign, or at least where they should reign. One may well criticize the way in which such transcendence and knowledge have been understood in Christianity, but one cannot cross over to a profane criticism that seizes on some polemical weapon or other, fantasizes over the supposed Aryan nature of the immanence doctrine, of natural religion, the cult of life, etc., without really losing one's level. In short, one does not thereby attain the world of primordial beginnings, but that of the counter-tradition or the telluric and primitive modes of being. This would in fact be the very best way of reconverting those people with the best pagan talents to Catholicism. One must be wary of falling into the misunderstandings and errors that we have mentioned, which basically serve only to defend the common enemy. One must try to develop the capacity to place oneself at that level where didactic confusion cannot reach, and where all dilettantism and arbitrary intellectual activity are excluded, where one resists energetically every influence from confused, passionate desires and from the aggressive pleasure in polemics, where, finally and fundamentally, nothing counts but the precise, strict, objective knowledge of the spirit of the primordial tradition. Julius Savola's Political Testament by Nigel Jackson in 1950. Julius Savola wrote Orientations, a pamphlet for a number of his young political associates, intended as a compendium that would set down the most important core values of a traditional rightist group. This pamphlet then led to the writing of Savola's main political book, Men Among the Ruins. Dr. H.D. Hansen, in his 100-page introduction to this first English translation of Savola's work, explains that Men Among the Ruins was written in the hope of influencing Italian politics of the time, but was not successful in that regard. Despite that, it was reprinted several times in Italy and was Savola's most commercially successful book. Hansen's claim that it probably was and has remained the only practical handbook for a truly traditional right wing may be an excessive claim. It is as much theoretical as practical, and an abundance of books of a traditional conservative bent have appeared in the same period, such as Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind and Eric Fogelin's The New Science of Politics. Hansen states that Savola himself felt that Men Among the Ruins was a failure. At much the same time, he also wrote a companion book, Riding the Tiger, in which he preached a gloomy doctrine of apolitia. Today there is no idea, no object, and no goal that is worth sacrificing one's own true interest for, he declared. Hansen, who rarely intrudes his own views in his brilliantly researched analysis of Savola's life and intellectual career, Finally, lets loose a severe judgment about the impracticality of men among the ruins. Evola's traditionalism cannot be used by modern political movements. According to Hansen, Evola's teachings are too aristocratic, too demanding, and too much directed against progress and modernity. In the 1930s and early 1940s, Evola strove in vain to influence Italian fascism and German National Socialism, which provided more fertile ground than the post-war era. Traditionalists must hold on to ideas and principles, not institutions, Hansen adds. He suggests that Evola would probably have held that his traditional doctrines should serve as centers of intelligence, around which groups might slowly form, which in the future might be nuclei in a providential transformation of society. In the 20th century, Australian right-wing political movements have enjoyed little success and sometimes proved to be fiascos. Senator George Hannan's 1970s National Liberal Party never got off the ground. More recently, Graham Campbell's Australia First has sunk amidst a cruel media silence, while Pauline Hanson's One Nation, although enjoying a degree of media puffing and some electoral successes, never lost the unhappy image of a slightly tawdry political circus. Perhaps a study of men among the ruins might help the Australian right achieve something more fruitful in the future. This article is offered as a contribution to that end. First, we will look briefly at Evola's life and the kind of person he was. Next, we will survey his intellectual career, relying on Hansen's substantial and succinct introduction. Finally, we will study the 175-page text of Men Among the Ruins itself and consider how it might be practically applicable in the Australian political arena today. Evola, the man. Baron Julius Evola was born into a family of the Sicilian gentry on 19th of May 1898, about a year and a half after Prince Giuseppe di Lampedusa, author of the plangent historical novel The Leopard, whose theme is the decay of the Sicilian aristocratic class. He received a strict Catholic upbringing, which he soon discarded. His was not the spirituality of piety and mysticism, comments Jocelyn Godwin in a brief foreword, but the aspiration to what he understood to be the highest calling of man, the identity of self and absolute. Evola also developed an unconditional and militant antipathy toward everything bourgeois, Hansen tells us. The fact that he never married, never wanted children, never had a middle-class job, and broke off his engineering studies before the last exam in spite of his excellent record can be traced back to this sentiment. There was plainly an austerity in Evola's makeup. It could be seen in his personal style of impeccable suits and monocle. It can equally be noted in his extraordinary reticence about his upbringing and personal life, which are hardly mentioned even in his autobiography, and in his attitude to personal property. It would be tempting to view him as a partly repressed personality with an unduly negative attitude to femininity, but there is evidence against this. For example, we learn from Hansen that, after the fall of Rome to the Allies in 1943, his mother kept their secret service operatives at bay while he made his escape. He evidently enjoyed good relations with her, despite having renounced Catholicism in his teens. Evola also wrote a whole book on Eros and the mysteries of love. Moreover, the second last chapter of Men Among the Ruins shows that he did not have a puritanical attitude towards sexuality. Evola seems to have been a knightly man with leanings towards the Brahminic lifestyle. On March 12, 1945, he was seriously wounded during an airstrike on Vienna and his spinal cord was damaged. He remained paralyzed from the waist down for the rest of his life. This disability was not allowed to curtail his dedication to tradition and his prodigious literary career. He wrote 25 books, around 300 long essays and over 1,000 newspaper and magazine articles. He translated into Italian many notable works including Oswald Spengler's Decline and Fall of the West, the Taoist classic, the Tao Te Ching, and René Guénon's The Crisis of the Modern World. Evola also introduced many notable European writers to the Italian public, including Gabriel Marcel, Ernst Junger, and Gustav Meyrink. Close personal friends from youth onwards included comparative religion authority Mircea Eliade and Tibetologist Giuseppe Tucci. After spending a year and a half in hospital in Austria, Evola returned to Rome and thenceforth rarely left his apartment. He was arrested in 1951 on the preposterous charge of glorification of fascism, detained for 6 months, proved innocent and acquitted. His famous auto dife is included as an appendix in Men Among the Ruins. He chose to die standing upright, since he wished to emulate forebears like Roland of France. Plainly there was much that was heroic in Avola's life, but was there also something of the quixotic? Intellectual career. Hansen points out that for Avola, from his mid-twenties onwards, the center of all things was not man but rather the transcendent, the eternal one without a second. Avola was a traditionalist in the sense made famous by Guénon, father of the perennialist school. Everything had to be appraised from the standpoint of the principles which form the foundation of our world and remain forever the same, that is to say, tradition. Avola's awareness of the vertical dimension of human existence was based on personal experience, which gave him keys to the mysteries of self-transformation. As Guido Stucco noted in his translator's preface to Avola's masterwork, Revolt Against the Modern World, Avola was not first and foremost a right-wing, reactionary political thinker, but an esotericist. His socio-political views sprang from his religious and metaphysical convictions. Avola upheld the primacy of being. For him there was an immortal nature as well as a mortal nature, a superior world of being as well as an inferior world of becoming. Avola considered human beings to be fundamentally and inherently unequal, so that they do not have and should not have, nor should they enjoy, the same dignity and rights. Therefore a socio-political hierarchy is best suited to express the differentiation between them. Avola tended to reject dialogue with the apostles of modernity as a waste of time. He favored self-questioning and the cultivation of one's soul. Stucco viewed Avola's whole oeuvre as a quest for, and as an exposition of, the means employed in Western and Eastern traditions to accomplish that noble task. Julius Avola, 1898-1998, here anno 1940 and 1973, the titles of Avola's other books available in English, but not yet mentioned, support this claim: The Doctrine of Awakening, The Yoga of Power, The Hermetic Tradition, Introduction to Magic, The Mystery of the Grail and Meditation on the Peaks. An apologetic tone appears periodically in Hansen's introduction, denoting a strong conviction that he has to deal with a largely uncomprehending if not downright hostile readership. So, for example, he states that Avola's mindset was formed in a relatively recent intellectual climate that seems to belong to a whole other world in its incisive questioning of what we regard today as self-evident humanism, a different world whose utterances seem barely publishable today. However, perhaps modernity is only standing tall on feet of clay, as its well-known tendency to discourage and even suppress antithetical political and historical theses testifies. Important early influences on Avola's thought were the medieval Christian mystics Meister Eckhart and Jan van Riesbroek. Hansen includes pertinent quotations from Eckhart, whom Avola respected throughout his life: being is God. God and existence are identical. Should I then be able to recognize God in an immediate way, then I must become he and he must become I, pure and simple, so completely at one, that this he and this I are one and will become and be one. Coarse-natured people must simply believe this, but the enlightened must know it. Plainly this is equivalent to the Hindu doctrine Tattvamasi, which proclaims the ultimate identity of the self and the divine source. A number of secular writers also influenced Avola in his youth. From Carlo Mitchell Stiedler he learned the vital importance of personal authenticity, of following the path of conviction, which has no road signs or directions that one can share, study or repeat, of not surrendering to contentment with what has been given to one by others. From Otto Weininger, author of Sex and Character, Avola derived his sense of the importance of manliness, his attitude towards woman as the metaphysical and political opposite of man, his dislike of populist Caesars and his hostility to the decadence of modernity. Plato played an important role in arousing Avola's anti-democratic views, as did Nietzsche, although Avola always cautioned against the hubris implicit in Nietzsche's ignoring of transcendence. Oswald Spengler alerted Avola to the fundamental decadence of modernity, despite its boasts about progress and the advances of science. From Spengler he learned that it is a sure sign of corruption of the body politic when the economy wins the upper hand. He agreed with Spengler's analysis of the onslaught of money against the spiritual in Western culture: only high finance is completely free, completely unsusceptible to attack. Since 1789, the banks and thus the stock exchanges have come into their own as a power, feeding off the credit needs of an industry growing into monstrous proportions. Now they, and money, want to be the sole power in all civilizations. From the crowd by Gustave Le Bon Évolo absorbed a pessimistic attitude towards the masses, whose natural tendency is to follow strength rather than virtue. And from Johann Jakob Backofen came the identification of the age of female rule with the age of earthbound, thonic deities, against which Évolo proposed the superiority of a solar, manly and Olympian rule. There is definitely error in Évolo's analysis here, as anyone who appreciates Robert Graves' The White Goddess and Starhawk's The Spiral Dance will agree. There is a Greco-Roman bias in Évolo which leaves inadequate room for the Celtic. Évolo was deeply influenced by texts of the non-dogmatic Eastern religions, including Buddhist Pali scriptures and the Hindu Bhagavad Gita. From Taoism he derived his understanding of the nature of power. The Tao Te Ching tells how the awakened one achieves self-fulfillment because he is selfless, and praises the superior man who leads and yet does not lord it over his fellows. Thus Évolo differentiated power from mere brute force. Superiority does not rest on power, but power rests on superiority. The path of renunciation can be a condition for the way to the highest power. A true ruler has access to this higher quantity of being, a different quality of being, and imposes himself through his mere presence. Évolo was 24 when Mussolini entered Rome at the invitation of King Victor Emmanuel III. He thus lived the years of his prime under fascism and naturally had hopes of influencing it, correcting it and steering it into aristocratic channels. In 1927, in his first political book, Imperialismo Pagano, he expressed concern at the direction fascism was taking. Caught up in the struggles and worries of concrete politics, fascism does not seem to be interested in creating a hierarchy in the higher sense, based on purely spiritual values and knowing only disdain for all pollutions due to culture and modern intellectualism, so that the center might again shift to a position that lies beyond secular and religious boundaries alike. His critique applied to Western nations generally, in the same way that a living body stays alive only when a soul is present to govern it, so every social organization not rooted in a spiritual reality is outward and transitory, unable to remain healthy and retain its identity in the struggle of the various forces. It is not really an organism, but more aptly something thrown together, an aggregate. The true cause for the decline of the political idea in the West today is to be found in the fact that the spiritual values that once permeated the social order have been lost, without any successful efforts to put something better in their place. The problem has been lowered to the plane of economic, industrial, military, governmental, or even more sentimental factors, without considering that all this is nothing more than matter, necessary if you like, but never enough by itself, and unable to create a healthy and reasonable social order. Relying on Dante's De Monarchia and other authorities, Évolo saw a monarchy as the natural gravitational and crystallizing point of the true right. This ideal implies the affirmation not only of the concept and right of the nobility, but also of the monarchy. It must be renewed, strengthened, and dynamized as an organic, central, absolute function that embodies the might of power and the light of the spirit in a single being. Then the monarchy is truly the act of a whole race, and at the same time the point that leads beyond all that is bound by blood and soil. Only then is one justified to speak of an imperium. When it is awakened into a glorious, holy, metaphysical reality, the pinnacle of a martially ordered political hierarchy, then the monarchy once again occupies the place and fulfills the function that it once had, before being usurped by the priestly caste. As Hansen observes, with this emphasis on a spiritual monarchy presiding over an imperial order, Évolo stood in sharp contrast to the principle of the leaders of fascism and National Socialism, both of whom derived their legitimacy, they claimed, from the people. Inevitably, he remained without political influence on either movement. He saw fascism as a degenerate child of tradition. It appeared to him as the last chance of the West. From his standpoint, the visible alternatives were much worse, explains Hansen. There were only liberalism paired with capitalism and communism, both of which worshipped a world of machines and limitless materialism. Fascism at least strengthened the state and the hierarchical concept and praised honor, bravery and loyalty. Avola believed that it was Italy that had failed fascism, rather than the other way around. The nation did not have enough men on the necessary plane of certain higher qualifications and symbols, capable of further developing the positive possibilities that could have been contained in the system. Hansen explains how National Socialism came to have greater appeal to Avola, partly because of its concept of a state ruled by an order, which he felt was embodied in the SS, yet he strongly warned against the inadequate respect for the transcendent. National Socialism has forsworn the ancient, aristocratic tradition of the empire, being nothing but a semi-collectivist nationalism and equalizing in its centralism. It has not hesitated to destroy Germany's time-honored division into duchies, counties and cities that all enjoyed a measure of independence. An extract from a lecture he gave in Berlin in 1937 shows how Avola saw Hitler's National Socialism as a caricature of a true conservative order. According to the Aryan primordial conception, the Reich is a metaphysical solar reality. The Nordic heritage is not semi-naturalistic, only conceivable on a blood and soil basis, but rather constitutes a cultural category, an original transcendent form of the spirit, of which the Nordic type, the Aryan race, and the general Indo-Germanic moral being are only outward manifestations. Race is a basic attitude, a spiritual power, something primal and creative. This is the true level to which the motifs and symbols that the new Germany has called forth must be elevated if it really wants to stand at the forefront of the resistance and attack against the dark powers of world revolution. Hansen stalwartly presents and assesses Avola's attitudes to race and to the Jewish question, intellectual minefields over which he steps delicately and honorably. He stresses that Avola's position regarding race was a consequence of his worldview. Avola wrote, "Our racial doctrine is determined by tradition. Thus the traditional view of the human being is our foundation, according to which this being has a tripartite nature, that is, it consists of three principles, spirit, soul and body. Race is a deeply embedded force that reveals itself in the biological and morphological realm, the psychical, as well as in the spiritual." And in 1928 he stated that races deteriorate when their spirits deteriorate. That is why for us the return to the race cannot be merely the return to the blood, especially in these twilight times in which almost irreversible mixtures have taken place. It must mean a return to the spirit, not in a totemistic sense but in an aristocratic sense, relating to the primordial seed of our form and our culture. As Hansen remarks, Avola not only fought vehemently against a purely physical racism, but also understood the term race differently from its general usage. His studies of Buddhist scriptures that continually mention the Arya and understand the Arya as the noble affected his employment of the word Aryan. The Sanskrit word Arya has a fourfold meaning: 1. Spiritually, the awakened ones; 2. Aristocratically, membership of a higher caste; 3. Racially, as of the light-skinned Nordic conquerors; 4. Stylistically, as of a crystalline clarity, lack of passionate emotion, ascetic manner, and detached attitude. Hansen condemns some of Avola's obsessions and utterances critical of Jewry, especially in appendix he wrote to the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which demonstrated sheer carelessness, a lack of serious research, and the reckless assimilation of prejudices that happened to coincide with his own views. On the other hand, Hansen points out that Avola's writings never spoke out against Orthodox religious Judaism. "There are elements and symbols in the Old Testament," Avola commented, "that possess metaphysical and therefore universal value." He also praised Kabbalah as one of the few initiatory paths that can still be followed successfully in the West today. His attacks were directed against the Jews as a symbol of the rule of economic materialistic individualism and the hegemony of money. A Jewish critic, Adriana Goldstaub, agreed that Avola did not deem all Jews, or the Jews exclusively, as responsible for the decline of the modern world. It is true, Hansen notes, that Avola was attracted to the theory of a global conspiracy by Jewish and Freemasonic circles, with the intention of toppling Christian and traditional state institutions, but he considered such circles not so much movers as instruments of other forces, not necessarily human. In summary, Avila engaged himself for almost 60 years in the fight to defend his principles. He embodied, says Hansen, the legionary spirit, which was a phrase he took both from the greatness of the Roman army and the legionary movement of one of his most admired heroes, the Romanian Corneliu Codranu. Avila defined the legionary spirit as the attitude of him who can choose the hardest life, who is able to continue fighting even when he knows that the battle is materially lost, who holds to the ancient precept that loyalty is mightier than fire and who carries the traditional idea of honor and dishonor within. Avila was something of a universal man. Amongst other pursuits, he found time as an alpinist for several difficult climbs, he felt at home among the mountains, and the mountain remained a potent and inspiring symbol for him of an arena where direct experience of the transcendent can occur. He requested in his will that after his death the urn containing his ashes be deposited in a glacial crevasse on Monte Rosa, and this was faithfully carried out by his executors and friends. Beyond doubt, Baron Julius Avila was a man of destiny and a great man. The closest figure for comparison in the English-speaking world is surely the traditional poet, dramatist and essayist, T.S. Eliot. It seems likely that Avila will exert more influence on the world after his life than in it. Conservative revolution in men among the ruins. Avila begins by considering what needs to be preserved by a truly authentic counter-revolution. He identifies his enemy as the subversion introduced in Europe by the revolutions of 1789 and 1848. In a passage remarkably reminiscent of words of T.S. Eliot in his 1917 essay Tradition and the Individual Talent, Avila defines the tradition that needs to be defended. Tradition is neither servile conformity to what has been, nor a sluggish perpetuation of the past into the present. Tradition, in its essence, is something simultaneously meta-historical and dynamic. It is an overall ordering force in the service of principles that have the chrism of a superior legitimacy. Thus, as Eliot, Russell Kirk and others also did, he warns against the error of a worldly, but short-sighted and partial, conservatism, involving merely the defense of the socio-political positions and the material interests of a given class, of a given caste. He stresses, too, the need to be faithful not so much to past forms and institutions as to the principles of which they were particular expressions. New forms, corresponding in essence to the old ones, are liable to emerge from them as if from a seed. In Australia, undoubtedly, imperfect forms and movements have come into being since Federation, which were not sufficiently rooted in traditional principles because their leaders lacked adequate understanding. The conservative revolution must emerge as a predominantly spiritual phenomenon, Avila insists. In Australia, some movements have paid insufficient attention to this fundamental. Others have been too closely attached to outdated and inadequate religious forms, such as the National Civic Council and National Action and the Australian League of Rights. Avila, naturally, focuses especially upon Italy, as he looks for historical forms that might be the basis for an integration that will immediately leave them behind. For him, these are the ancient Roman world and certain aspects of medieval civilization. This prompts the question of what forms we in Australia should seek as supports, and immediately it must be stressed that for us Australian history cannot be viewed as beginning with the brave seamen who discovered our continent only a few centuries ago. For us, despite the barrage of contemporary propaganda to the contrary, Australia remains a fundamentally British nation. Thus our history extends back to the foundations of Britain itself, and its four kingdoms of England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. Our supports will be found from a period of two millennia. The basis of sovereignty. Avila's second chapter is one of his most important. He proceeds from the conviction that the principle of the true state is itself founded upon transcendence. As soon as Avila moves downwards from this metaphysical point of origin, his formulations require careful critical examination. For example, he admires the pure power of command, the almost mystical power and auctoritas inherent in one who had the function and quality of leader, a leader in the religious and warrior order as well as in the order of the patrician family, the gens. Here, already, is a possible weakness in Avila. Himself by nature a Kshatriya, he tends to wrongly annex for his caste the superior authority of the Brahmins, just as, In places, he demeans the Brahmins by confusing them with priests who he sees as usurpers of the original royal authority. Of the principle of sovereignty, Evola writes that it is also necessary to recognize its attribute of absoluteness. Such an absoluteness can only belong to the one divine source, irrespective of what name is given to this source.